Can you remember the last time we have this many consecutive days of great weather?
Nice weather. I hope the streak keeps going.
I do too.
I hope it keeps going. Don't stop now.
No.
It
is wonderful.
Yeah, it's going to be very nice as the sun just starts to peek out over the horizon here in downtown Detroit. It's good to have you here on a Tuesday morning. Lots to talk about once again. Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, was in town yesterday. He and Governor Gretchen Whitmer, members from Oracle and Related Digital, visited the hyperscale data center site that is being built in Saline Township. It's being called the Saline Barn, which I got to be honest, I kind of like.
I kind of like it too.
It's a former farm site. I kind of dig it. But there were a number of people there. They talked about this 1.65 million square foot facility and the impact that it could have on our region, on the more immediate community of Saline, but then the $16 billion data center campus and what it means for the surrounding areas. I think it's interesting. I don't mind it. I like it. I understand why people don't necessarily yet.
Yeah.
But I think this is the type of moves that you need to make here in a state where things are kind of sliding in the wrong direction.
I know officials say the facility is going to create thousands of union construction jobs, generate about $8 million a year for local schools, and use a closed-loop cooling system designed to reduce water usage. And at the groundbreaking, Sam Altman said that the site could eventually power scientific and educational breakthroughs, even suggesting it could play a role in curing diseases and expanding global learning.
This could very well turn into the site where cancer gets cured.
Wow.
Altman said. This could turn into the site where hundreds of millions of students around the world learn to get private tutoring. This could turn into a site where millions of small businesses can run their businesses with AI in the cloud. A gigawatt of AI can do all of those things.
And the project is also drawing pushback from some nearby residents who argue it raises concerns about environmental impact, transparency, and quality of life. Critics say they are not convinced the benefits outweigh the cost. So you just, you know, we've talked about this and we were up in Mackinac. We talked about it. You know, a lot of this is misinformation and people getting misinformation, or they hear it from somewhere else that's, you know, not good information, and they just take it and run with it.
Sure.
And they just go. But, you know, there are areas I kind of wish city council would take a look here in Detroit and see if there are a lot of land that we can parcel together in the city that could have a data center here, definitely.
I think it would be interesting to look at.
Yeah.
I mean, again, yeah. I don't think anybody should at this point be, you know, thumbing their nose at any of these projects. We want to ask questions. You want to get the information. You want to talk it through.
Yes.
All for
100%.
It. But to kind of poo-poo it and push it aside, I don't think that makes a lot of sense, especially when you look at the other states and how they are
right around
are just springing these things up.
Yeah. How many did they have in Ohio?
Over 100.
In Ohio already that
yes.
are running.
Correct.
Up. Wow. Drivers in Detroit are finally seeing some relief at the pump, with gas prices falling sharply over the past week. According to Gas Buddy, the average price for unleaded fuel in the city, now $4.33 per gallon, down about 25 cents in just 7 days and more than 50 cents lower than a month ago, but prices are still more than a dollar higher than this time last year. The lowest reported price in Detroit, around $3.79, while some stations are still as high as $5.99 a gallon. Analysts say the drop is being driven by falling oil prices, shifting global supply concerns, including speculation over a possible U.S.-Iran agreement. However, experts warn that relief may not last, with renewed geopolitical tensions and market uncertainty potentially pushing prices back up in the weeks ahead.
$5.99, not in Michigan.
Yeah. The lowest in Detroit, $3.79. Some stations still as high as $5.99 in Detroit. Now, if you're selling gas for $5.99,
in Detroit,
you are gouging people.
I bet you haven't seen a car in days.
No, nobody's
at
there.
$5.99.
No, nobody's driving up to that station.
Holy moly, $5.99.
Oh my God.
Did you see this story between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu? This conversation
heard
they had
a nice little conversation, a little fiery.
Well,
I understand.
So the story out of Axios was Donald Trump lashing out at BB over the escalation in Lebanon, because yesterday Iran threatened to abandon all negotiations with the United States over Israel. On the call, Donald Trump, according to reports, called Netanyahu crazy and accused him of not being grateful, saying that he would be in jail if it weren't for him, and that he ended up putting the brakes on Israel's plan to continue those strikes in southern Lebanon. One U.S. official said Donald Trump told Netanyahu that following through on these bombs with the Lebanese capital in Beirut would further isolate Israel from around the world. He said, "You're bleeping crazy. You'd be in prison if it weren't for me. I'm saving your bleep. Everybody hates you now. Everybody hates Israel because of this." And then Donald Trump went on True Social and said, "I had a conversation with Bibi today. We talked about Lebanon and Beirut and the conversation, and we talked to people, and everything is, thanks, Bibi. Hopefully this lasts a long time."
Yeah.
So, again, you might see a bit of the dichotomy, but, again, that's what Axios outlets like Politico are reporting to. Interesting.
Well, the president also shrugged off a reporter's question about the stalled negotiations with Iran, bluntly declaring, quote, "I really don't care if they're over, because they had started to get very boring."
Okay.
I mean, okay.
It's not what I'd love to hear.
I don't like to hear that either, because you're bored that, you know, you just want to quit negotiating.
Yeah, no, I'm okay on that.
Okay.
The script from Only in Monroe, Stephen Colbert's spoof show on Monroe Public Access, is now being auctioned off on eBay. I did hop on just to see what it's going for.
Okay.
You can buy one. I think there are two listings, unless they're the same one, but they're going for different prices. So I'm going to say they are different.
Probably the 2015 and then the recent one, or is it?
These are both from 2026.
Oh, both from 2026. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And one is going for $2,750, and the other one is going for $3,000.
Okay.
And there's a little write-up. It's autographed by Stephen Colbert, Jack White, Jeff Daniels, Michelle Bauman, a couple of other folks as well. And there's a certificate of authenticity that's signed by Stephen Colbert. And the proceeds are going to charity.
To charity, yeah.
So, pretty cool. Dig it.
Huh.
Do you have any sort of, like, memorabilia like that?
I have.
I have sports memorabilia. I have, you know, signed baseballs or pucks or whatever, footballs, helmets. But I don't have anything like a script or anything.
I want to say I have some signed concert tickets. I got to remember who it is.
Signed concert tickets?
Yeah. My sister, who worked in media, worked in advertising for a long time, has the basketball signed by all the Bad Boys.
Oh, that's cool. That's very cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
She still has that.
Speaking of the Bad Boys last night, Dylan Dingler, Kerry Carpenter, and Riley Green. Back to back. It is. I love the cold cut there at the end. Very nice.
Yeah.
Tigers actually going to win 10-9 over the Rays.
Can we sustain that?
You know what? I got a little bit of audio from the clubhouse yesterday from the Tigers.
We won a game yesterday.
Oh,
we win
God.
One today. That's two in a row. We win one tomorrow, that's called a winning streak.
I woke up this morning going, I need to get that drop.
Jason's got a little pep in his step. I've seen him walking around a little bit. Yeah, back-to-back-to-back home runs, and Jason's feeling good. Coming up on the other side, Merrick Masters of Wayne State's going to join us. American Axle 3 Rivers plant, the UAW plant out in West Michigan, going on strike. What's it mean? It's next on JR Morning. Well, UAW workers have gone on strike at a key auto supplier in West Michigan, Three Rivers, and that's just south of Kalamazoo. And it could cause a real problem for GM's truck production, particularly the Chevy Silverado, the GMC Sierra, because this particular facility produces axles and components for their pickup trucks.
Yeah.
So you're talking about 1,000 UAWs working out. Negotiations fell off the table, so now they're out of the building on strike. What does that mean? Merrick Masters is the Professor Emeritus of Management at the Mike Ilitch School of Business at Wayne State University and joins us once again this morning. Professor, it's good to have you back.
Oh, thank you for having me this morning.
What happened here?
Well, they are apart on some of the critical economic issues. The UAW Local 2093 is trying to catch up from the concessions that it made in 2008, just like the UAW did in its major negotiations with the Big Three in 2023. And its wages are lagging considerably behind. They're lagging behind the non-union industry in the parts part of the auto manufacturing sector. And they're trying to catch up and get a contract more like the Big Three got in 2023.
You know, the company says it wants to reach a fair agreement and continue negotiating in good faith. When you look at labor disputes like this, what are usually the biggest obstacles that prevent both sides from getting a deal done before strike deadline?
Well, I think it's a test of wills. I think that the union believes that the company has more to give and hasn't given as enough as it should, and it's willing to exercise its right to strike and apply economic pressure. So this really becomes a test of wills after this point in time to determine who can last longest in a strike.
It doesn't feel like it's a small dispute. I mean, it's with this one particular facility, but it shows you how vulnerable the supply chain is. If the unions are going to strike, I mean, you could be talking for GM a real lag in the production of their trucks.
Well, the GM's some of its most profitable vehicles are the Sierra and the Silverado that are produced in Flint. GM produced about 950,000 of those last year. 350,000 of those were produced in Flint. Since they're highly profitable, the UAW depends on these product. And depending upon the level of inventory they have, this strike, the longer it takes, obviously could have a dampening effect on production and sales.
Professor, the UAW has been far more aggressive under Sean Fain's leadership. Do you see this strike as part of a broader shift in the organized labor's willingness to kind of push harder for gains after years of concessions?
I do. I think if you listen to the video that Shane and the International had as the strike was to be launched, it was pretty clear that they were saying, look, we're serious. We were serious when we said the deadline was May 31st. We're not going to extend that. They didn't. They struck. And they're willing to see, let the chips fall where they may in this challenge to American Axle, now the Bausch company.
I'm curious to know, from your perspective, what Sean Fain's standing is in the union at this point. Obviously, he was popular during 2023 when they were negotiating with the Big Three, but what does his standing now? Because there's been some investigations into him, into the UAW again. Is there still as much support for him now as there was 3 years ago?
Well, I would say the support has probably suffered somewhat because of the challenges that he's faced before the monitor on activities associated with some of his other executive level officers. But I would say that this is an effort to reclaim the glory, if you will, of the heyday of the record contracts. And we'll see how this plays out. But Sean Fain's saving grace, I think, in this entire thing is that he doesn't appear to have any formidable opposition as they come into the upcoming convention and presidential election.
Professor, how much pressure does, you know, each passing day put on either side? I mean, is there a point where the economics begin to force a settlement?
Well, of course it does, and that's what a strike is all about. It's more pressure on the workers who are dependent upon their wages, which they have to sacrifice, and they substitute strike benefits, which are a little more lucrative under recent agreement by the UAW, but are still not sufficient for them to sustain their standard of living. So as workers suffer, they'll be facing more pressure. The company obviously faces pressure. It doesn't want a disruption in its production or in its sales. But it has greater staying power, generally speaking, particularly a large company that has 18,000 people across the world, only 5,000 of which are in the United States, and American Axle.
You mentioned the 2008 financial crisis as being the impetus for this, and they haven't gotten their wages back to where they were then. Are there other suppliers that could face something similar to this, and the UAW looking at them as potential strike targets?
Well, they're all going to face things to the extent that they have a gap between what the big three record contracts provided in terms of wages. And most of the companies will have gaps. And the gap is greater in the parts industry, particularly those that haven't recovered yet from the 2008 concessions made. It's important to note in just historical fact that American Axle used to be a company that that GM managed, that it produced these parts itself, and it spun them off in 1994.
When workers, you know, say that their colleagues are struggling to afford groceries and rent and health care despite working full time, what does that tell us about really the broader state of manufacturing wages in America today?
Well, real wages have gone up some, but they are being eroded by an increase in inflation. A number of things which have contributed to that, including rising oil prices. But I think that manufacturing as a whole, and manufacturing in auto, is struggling. It's had a tough adjustment to the tariff regime of the Trump administration, but that seems to have stabilized somewhat. But manufacturing in auto has declined by, you know, several thousand jobs since April of last year.
Yeah.
And that's not what people, you know, were promised when Trump got into office.
Merrick Masters, always appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
You too. Auto sales, stock market gains, and inflation. It's next. All right, so we're here in June, but we're still watching auto sales for 2026 very closely, and a lot is riding for automakers on stock market gains, where inflation goes,
yeah,
what the rates that are being set by Kevin Warsh now as the new head of the Fed as a way to potentially springboard auto sales. All of these things are at play. It's all part of our Mobility Makers topic today. And Dr. Tim Nash, the director of the Northwood University Center for the Advancement of Free Enterprise and Entrepreneurship, joins us to talk about it. Doc, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Great to be back, Chris. Great to be back, Lloyd.
So let's talk about it. What are some of the things that are dependent for what the OEMs they're looking at to have a profitable, good 2026?
Well, as you noted, you know, there are a lot of issues with inflation. Inflation is going to affect the purchasing power of the consumer. Inflation is going to affect fuel prices, which is all part of owning and operating an automobile. Inflation is going to affect what the you know, the amount of money that the manufacturer pays to finance and manufacture automobiles. So I think in the end, if you look at it, inflation affects so many components of the automobile. I just named a few. That to me is the biggest issue. And then the next biggest issue are tariffs. Tariffs are costing money for parts, trade restrictions. You may not be able to bring as much over, say, if you're Chrysler from operation in Canada. And so in a lot of ways, the trade constraints are up there as well.
The average vehicle on American roads is now about 13 years old. What does that tell us about the financial health and the confidence of consumers?
Well, Lloyd, I think it tells you two things. One, consumers are holding on to automobiles longer, but it also tells us that today is the heyday of the quality of automobiles, that they last that long, that they're of that caliber, and they last long. They if you take care of them, if you change your oil on a 2,000 to 3,000 mile basis, automobiles today are the best they've ever been built across the board, whether it be Europe, Asia, the United States. That's the biggest thing that that tells us. In some cases, to your point, you know, people are looking to get that extra year out of their automobile because prices are tough, their incomes, their real purchasing power is down.
Yeah.
But the overall number one reason is that we produce, the world produces great automobiles.
The USMCA is up for renegotiation this year. How important is that going to be for automakers and what they're expecting for the rest of the year and then into the future?
Well, you know, that's going to be quite interesting as you look at especially what happens with Chinese automobiles. It'll be interesting to look at the trade in between the three countries. But, you know, there's a lot of discussion with the Canadian economy now in recession and the U.S. and Canada not having real good trade relations or, you know, political relations at that. There's a lot of discussion regarding whether or not we'll bring Chinese automobiles in, but especially whether our partners will bring Chinese automobiles in. Let's face it, China is producing a pretty good automobile. And the reality of it, Chris, is that when you look at that automobile, it's inexpensive. It is pretty good in terms of Deloitte's point, putting a lot of miles on the road before the car has to be, you know, either a major overhaul or the car scrapped. So I think those are the big factors.
From the automaker's perspective, prices remain high, yet we're hearing about, you know, shrinking profit margins. How can both things be true at the same time?
Well, again, what I would say is there's a lot of competition out there. So number one, as you look at profit margins, the high cost of financing is reducing profit margins. The fact that, the margin you make on a car is one thing. Mm-hmm. The number of cars you can sell is another thing. So the reality of it is it's not just for the dealers, but it's also for the manufacturers. And again, Lloyd, I would also note that, unlike some people who noted these issues before, a lot of the data from economic storefronts is that the tariffs are taking a lot more out of the bottom line.
Yeah.
I spoke to the Chamber of Commerce about this time last year in Lansing, and I've never seen a case in history where the key economists, such as in the old days Milton Friedman, would argue that tariffs are good, and sometimes there's a lag of up to a year that the costs work their way through the system. But another factor right now is the margins are down because the tariff costs have to be accounted for.
Mm, interesting. Always good analysis. Dr. Tim Nash at Northwood University, thank you for your time. As always, we'll talk again very soon.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Yeah, you got it. We appreciate it. One of the other stories that came out of Mackinac that we haven't really talked about much, there's a new survey that shows Michigan parents are more stressed and overwhelmed than parents on the national stage. Parents reported higher levels of hardships than parents across the United States. Debt and financial pressure, housing instability, unpredictable work schedules, all as a reason. About 41% of Michigan parents said they had to borrow money or take on debt just to cover basic needs. That's above the 29% national average. This it comes from some of the discussions up on the island and a study that was done with Capita and YouGov.
Mm-hmm.
200 of 1,800 parents were from the state of Michigan, and they focused on financial pressure, instability at work, and even housing instability as a reason for the anxiety to go up in some of the parents here in the state of Michigan.
So, you know, the items, prices of items are going up, pay is not going up, so I'm sure that's causing stress. And I'm sure a lot of people are dipping it. I'm just going to say I know some people who are, you know, dipping into their 401s. They don't want to, but they have to because they're trying to make sure they can have ends meet.
Well, and we're in an age now where there are so many other external worries.
Yeah, right.
For your kids.
Absolutely.
Right? And it's social media. It's what they're watching on television. It's, what they're getting at school, things like that. That's tried and true. Mm-hmm. All of those things are things that you have to deal with and go through and be there for your kids when they got a hard day. All sure. those things, those sure. don't necessarily cause anxiety. But if you don't have the means to then provide for them on just some basic necessities, that's the problem.
Yes. That's the issue. Yes.
That's the problem. Mm-hmm. If you're worried about schedules and not having childcare because you got to go to work, that does cause a lot of anxiety. It causes a lot of stress on families, on parents. Now, there is a benefit. I mean, some people have a little more flexibility because they work from home or
right.
they can, you know, be there in a emergency if they needed to more quickly. But it doesn't take it away for a lot of these parents.
No, and, you know, and some kids like, you know, some kids do extracurricular things.
Sure.
And, you know, parents don't have the wherewithal, the means to do that. That can cause a little anxiety, too, because you want your kids to, you know, be able to have that outlet if they want to, you know. And if you can't afford it, that can cause some anxiety as well.
We'll get you the latest on the peace talks with the United States and Iran next on JR Morning. Well, there seemed to be some sort of movement in the right direction between Israel and Hezbollah yesterday that
yeah.
those hostilities would stop because they've been active the last couple of days.
They have. And the president spoke with Bibi and spoke with Hezbollah, and they're supposed to cool it for a while.
They're supposed to cool it for a while, but there was apparently the conversation with Benjamin Netanyahu got a little heated yesterday.
Little heated.
How does that impact the talks between the United States and Iran? Let's ask Lucas Tomlinson, our Fox News reporter. Lucas, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning, guys. Great to be back with you. Back from on American shores this time.
How about that? It's nice to have you back in town. Let's talk about it. First, let's talk about the conversation between Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump yesterday. There was reporting that things got a little tense. What's that about?
Really, when it comes to the ending the war in Iran, it is very clear that Iran wants to link the end of the war with Israel's actions in Lebanon and its ongoing war with Hezbollah. And what the president rather forcefully, it was reported, told Israel's prime minister is that he wants the ceasefire, which is what Iran wants, in Lebanon between Israel and Hezbollah. And President Trump says, after speaking to Bibi and Hezbollah through intermediaries, that both sides have agreed to stop the fighting. However, we've seen this before, guys. Remember, in April, there was supposed to be a ceasefire.
Right.
And in fact, things got even more heated, and Israeli forces went even deeper into Lebanon. But for now, the strikes that Israel was threatening against Beirut have been suspended. But really, what the big takeaway from this is that Iran is linking the end of the war with Israel's actions in Lebanon. Iran wants the ceasefire to extend to Lebanon, and that has been a major source of contention with the White House and Jerusalem.
Lucas, President Trump said we've been talking too much, and he suggests going silent might be beneficial. Is that a negotiating tactic, or does that signal just some growing frustration inside the White House?
Well, I was at the White House all day yesterday, guys, and the president kept a very low profile. No public appearances. I saw a U.S. Marine Corps corporal outside the West Wing for most of the afternoon, which means the president's in the Oval Office. Presumably, that's where he called Bibi and the representatives from Hezbollah. The president has not made a lot of public statements. However, he did take some calls from some reporters. He issued a few posts on Truth Social. And at one point, he told CNBC he didn't really care about the talks. We've heard him say he told his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, over the weekend that he was in no hurry for an agreement. And in early May, he said there's no deadline for this deal. So that's part of the low profile. Of course, you know, you get one shot at this, and the president wants to make sure that he gets a deal that's beneficial to the United States. Now, the president has his red lines. He wants Iran to give up its nuclear program. He wants the Strait of Hormuz open, not just for a trickle of ships, but you know, on any regular day, the Strait of Hormuz, you should have 130 ships passing through there. But there was a lot of, you know, U.S. and Iran traded fire over the weekend, you know, and there are some people, General Jack Keane, who are saying that this ceasefire is in name only and the ceasefire is not holding. U.S. forces hit targets ashore in Iran after Iran said they shot down an American Predator drone. And then early yesterday morning, Iran fired two ballistic missiles into Kuwait. Of course, that's where some U.S. forces are based, and that's where the U.S. Army has HIMARS systems that was firing those satellite-guided rockets into Iran at the start of the war. Both those ballistic missiles Iran fired were intercepted, but just shows how tenuous this ceasefire is between both sides. The action continues.
Is that why there seems to be some growing tensions between the White House and Republicans in Congress? Because, the president has said things like, well, I'm not worried about the finances of Americans because I'm focused on basically denuclearizing Iran. Or now with his most recent comments, like, I'm not in a hurry. I don't care. We'll figure it out. Is that frustrating Republicans on Capitol Hill because we're in a midterm cycle now?
There's no question about that. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio will be on Capitol Hill this morning for ostensibly a budget panel on the Senate side. But that there's no question that the war will come up. Of course, probably the leading economic indicator is the price of gasoline. We all see it. When I came back to the United States, you're driving around. What do you see? You see the price of gas and nice big numbers on the road when you drive around. You know that the price of gas is over $4 nationwide, and that's one of the reasons some people think Iran is stalling on this deal, because they think the longer they go and the closer the midterms, the less there'll be the appetite from President Trump to resume any kind of major combat operation. So it appears that Iran is stalling, and other Republicans we heard on Fox News Sunday. A number of lawmakers talk about, because the leadership is so discombobulated, was the word of one senator, it's hard to negotiate with Iran right now because of just where the status is with communications and getting a deal. But that's the state of play right now. It appears Iran is stalling on this agreement, and they think the longer they stall, the more beneficial to them. But you mentioned some of the criticism from Republicans. We heard the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator Roger Wicker from Mississippi. There's a lot of hawks on Capitol Hill who would like to see the president take more actions and resume combat, major combat operations in Iran.
Lucas, how concerned are U.S. allies in the Middle East about where this situation is heading?
Well, they're concerned because they don't want most of them. Most of the Persian Gulf allies don't want to see a return to the war, because they remember, especially where I reported from 2 months, the United Arab Emirates. They received 2,800 Iranian missiles and drones, twice as much as any other country received, including Israel. They don't want to see that happen. The major issue, of course, is just reopening the Strait of Hormuz. It's not just where 20% of the world's oil flows through, but it's also 30% of the world's fertilizer. You have a lot of American farmers that are impacted by this. And people want to see this end. But Iran appears to be using all this to its benefit. And that's why, when it comes to, we heard from Senator Chris Coons talk about, Iran has perfected the use of cheap drones. They're using those drones to keep the Strait of Hormuz closed. Even President Trump admitted to Brett Baer in Beijing a few weeks ago, just the threat of a drone attack keeps the strait closed. And by the way, guys, just yesterday we saw another ship attack, this time off the coast of Iraq in the Persian Gulf.
Lucas Tomlinson, always great insight. Thank you so much for your time again this morning. We'll talk again soon.
Yes, indeed. Let's see where this goes.
No doubt. You got it. That's Lucas Tomlinson at Fox News. Yeah, and he's right. Iran is the pressure point now for Iran is stall, delay.
Oh, yeah.
Wait it out.
Slow walking.
And put the pressure on the president politically.
Yes.
Back here at home. Coming up on the other side, 7 o'clock hour, get you caught up on the headlines. What's up with the weaponization fund? We'll tell you about it. All right, 7 o'clock hour. Good to have you. Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Sam Altman, the head of OpenAI, were in Saline breaking ground on the new Saline Barn, as they're calling it.
The barn.
The 1.65 million square foot data center that's being built there. And Sam Altman talked a little bit about what this facility could do. He said it could very well turn into the site where cancer gets cured.
Wow. That would be amazing. That's huge.
It would be amazing. It is the benefit of having these facilities. It's the benefit of artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. and using it as a tool, particularly in medicine. And of course he's painting a rosy picture of what data centers
sure
are. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of pushback, obviously, here in the state of Michigan, particularly people from in these communities.
Yeah.
Because of the uncertainty of what this is. Meanwhile, you've got neighboring states that are building these things left, right, and center.
Ohio.
Yeah, that's, I mean, they're popping with data centers.
Yeah.
So again, if you embrace it, it's one of the things that was talked about on Mackinac Island for the policy conference when we were there last week.
Yeah.
It is you may not like something, right? You may not totally agree with everything on a particular issue, but if you have a similar track going in one direction where everybody can follow, depending on, you know, what letter you have in front of your name, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Is there a cohesive track that we can all follow to help Michigan prosper? And right now, one of the major economic drivers in a lot of states are these data centers.
And you know, it's okay for you to question and want to know what these data centers mean in your communities, in
totally
your neighborhood. But I would also say, you know, talk to the people in other states that have these data centers,
sure,
and see how they feel, how those data centers have affected their communities so far. And I think that's, you know, do your due diligence as well.
Yeah. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, there's been a tough go to try to pass this reconciliation bill through that, mm-hmm, would fund CBP, ICE, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the roadblocks they were facing was this anti-weaponization fund that the president had created.
Yes.
And it had drawn a lot of pushback. And Senate Majority Leader John Thune, other GOP senators, and say now they see a path for passing this stalled budget reconciliation package on immigration enforcement after the president signaled yesterday that they would back down from this anti-weaponization fund. $1.8 billion
yeah
fund, by
mm-hmm
the way.
Mm-hmm.
And John Thune had called on the White House to just scrap this plan completely. He called it, he and some other GOP critics had called it a slush fund, which is kind of how it feels to me. But regardless, they are backing down, they being the White House now, it seems, according to reports. And now John Thune says, well, now we might see a path here for this reconciliation bill.
Well, I know U.S. Senator Alyssa Slotkin was introducing some new legislation that was aimed at blocking that fund, and it was co-sponsored by Senators Adam Schiff and Mark Kelly. It would prohibit taxpayer money from being used to pay the president, his associates, or individuals connected and convicted of crimes, including those tied to the January 6th attack.
Yeah, Thune said the best way to get the reconciliation bill moving across the finish line is to confine it to the issues that we were addressing in the initial bill, which was CBP and ICE funding for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
And the package, according to a report in The Hill, will not include funding for security upgrades for the White House ballroom as well.
Oh, okay. A Wayne County judge has rejected a legal challenge that sought to block a proposed millage renewal and expansion of smart bus service from appearing on the August ballot. Circuit Court Judge Kathleen McCarthy dismissed the case brought by a group called Not Smart Wayne, which argued that officials violated the Open Meetings Act during a March vote and that the ballot language was misleading. Supporters of the lawsuit say residents were not properly informed about the meeting, while Wayne County officials argue they follow the law and acted transparently. The millage would fund smart bus operations across 17 Wayne County communities for 10 years and is expected to raise about $57 million in its first year. Officials say it helps support transit access for seniors, people with disabilities, and those without vehicles. Wayne County Executive Warren Evans praised the ruling, while opponents say they're considering an appeal as the measure now heads to voters in August.
Interesting.
It's a big deal in Wayne County. Oakland County has, you know, accepted it. Macomb County, they accepted it. Wayne County was the only county that had communities that could do a buyout.
Yeah, other cities that broke off.
It could buy out. This way, this is a vote all in or all out.
All in or all out.
Yep.
Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump allegedly spoke on the phone yesterday. Got a little contentious.
Is that what we call it?
Look, Lloyd, it's 7:10 in the morning.
I'm just just saying. It was a little spicy from what I understand.
It sounds like it was a little spicy. Axios reporting that Trump called Netanyahu crazy. At one point, Donald Trump allegedly yelled at Benjamin Netanyahu, "What the F are you doing?"
He wanted to get his point across.
I feel like the point got across.
Yeah.
Because while Iran is trying to tie the broader negotiations with the United States with Lebanon and Israel, that the hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon have continued. There's been military action on both sides. Even while their ceasefire between those two were put into place. So the president's point is, well, hold on a second. We're trying to do something over here diplomatically.
Yeah.
And you're muddying the waters. Now, whether or not you agree that the bill with or the deal with Israel and Lebanon should be included in this, I guess we could talk about that.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump is, I think, at least what it seems like, is he's trying to broker a deal to stop all of this.
Exactly. It complicates things if they continue while he's trying to broker this deal with Iran.
Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, blue states were talking about taxing this weaponization fund 100%.
100%, yeah.
So if you got benefits from this weaponization fund that you were going to be taxed, you aren't going to get any of it.
Right.
But now the president seems to be backing away from it. What does that mean? At first, 712, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, and spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. A valuable brand is, of course, one of the most valuable assets a business can possess. And Kantar just came out last week by announcing the results of its annual Brands Report. That's B-R-N-D-Z report. The research company's ranking of the 100 most valuable brands in the world. Kantar assesses a brand's value by multiplying its calculated financial value with a metric it calls brand contribution, defined as the ability of the brand to deliver value to the company by predisposing consumers to choose that brand, even in cases where you have to pay more from that brand than others. The head of the Kantar study says this about it. Martin Guerrera says, by incorporating subtler attributes like perception, we're valuing something that's intangible, and that makes our study unique, and that the result is a more nuanced reading of potency than an examination of fiscals alone. Now, before we announce the world's top brand in this study, what sector has the most valuable brands in general? Well, it's those in technology. Technology brands overall maintain the strongest presence, with the likes of Oracle, IBM, Cisco, Intel, and Intuit all snagging places in the top 50. And of course, in this sector, we've also got AI brands like NVIDIA at number 5, ChatGPT at number 15, and Claude at number 27. While Kantar's most valuable brands list encompasses sectors ranging from tech to luxury to fast food, according to the company, one thing all brands making its list have this common achievement, that is that they're able to make a meaningful difference in the minds of consumers. Okay, so without further ado, we've got a change at the top spot this year. We do indeed. Google has edged Apple out as the number one spot on this list now. Apple had occupied the number one spot for the last 4 years. This year, it's Google. The tech giant's brand value grew 57% over last year, according to the data and analytics giant, which now values it at $1.48 trillion. There you have it. Most powerful brands in the world, according to Kantar Brands Report. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So reports started surfacing yesterday that Donald Trump was going to back off this weaponization fund, this $1.8 billion for those that could make the case that they were wronged by the federal government. And as a result, you had, as a result of the announcement of this fund initially, you had blue states like California and Gavin Newsom saying that, well, if anybody in my state gets this money, we're going to tax you 100%. You're not going to get any of it.
Some of the other blue states were thinking about doing following suit, right?
Yeah, and all of a sudden, you've got blue states taking over federal money, and you're like, whoa, hold on a second. But now the president's backed off of it. Now what? Dan Marica is the co-author of the Early Brief newsletter for The Washington Post and joins us this morning. Dan, what a great name to have for the 250. My goodness.
Thank you so much. Yes. People think it's a pen name, but it's actually my real name. That's, I was born with
wow.
it.
Wow.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Thanks for your time this morning. Let's talk about it. What did you make initially of the announcement of this fund and then yesterday as the report started breaking that the White House was backing away from it?
I mean, clearly this is something that the president has harbored, not in private, in public for a long time. He's talked about how he's felt wronged by the federal government for years. It's kind of animated his second term and his kind of rise from losing in 2020 to winning again in 2024. So this is something that he has been public about for a long time. I think it was pretty clear quite quickly how unpopular it was, though. I mean, it takes a lot for Republicans on Capitol Hill to break with the president, as we've seen over this term. And this was something that they were publicly breaking with the president on. Yes, they were going to him directly, going to the administration, urging him to end this. And it was seeming like if they don't decide to end it themselves, that there will be a number of votes on Capitol Hill where Republicans will be forced to either vote to continue this fund or vote to break with the president. And that's a pretty tough position to put Republicans in, especially in a midterm year. You've got a lot of Republicans who are up for re-election, obviously every Republican in the House and a number of Republicans in the Senate. And they don't want to be put in that position of taking a tough vote that puts them between the president and what is maybe popular with voters. You saw that yesterday with Senate Majority Leader John Thune bluntly telling reporters that the best way for this to be handled was for the administration to decide to shut it down themselves and not put the Senate in a place where they have to vote to block it or stop it in any way.
Dan, can a state realistically impose a 100% tax on a specific category of payments, or would courts just likely view that as an attempt to kind of circumvent the run around the federal policy?
It's a good question. There were some legal questions that we were stewing over when we wrote our story about the 100% tax. I asked Michael Bennett, who is currently a senator from Colorado, but is the leading Democratic candidate for governor in Colorado. He was in favor of implementing the 100% tax, came out in favor of it. It's particularly relevant in Colorado because you have a former election official who was put in jail because of her work around kind of forward President Donald Trump's mistruths about the 2020 election. She was actually just granted clemency and is now out of jail, and Vice President J.D. Vance even raised this person's name at the press briefing as somebody who could be qualified to get a payout from the government. So it's particularly relevant in Colorado. I asked the senator and possibly the next governor of the state if he had heard of any legal issues. He had not, but there are certainly questions about how you target a tax like that. For a lot of Democrats, this was just a kind of a creative way to A, voice their opposition to this payout fund, but B, I think there were some Democrats who thought they could make this work. And if somebody from their state got a payout like this, that they would just take 100% of that payout. I do think you are right in asking that question, though. That a lot of this, if it goes forward, will probably end up in the courts.
I want to go back to something you said, because I think it's interesting. You're right. It does take a lot for Republicans on Capitol Hill to break with the president, but tying this in with the reconciliation bill, with the budget for the ballroom, all seemed to be too much, and it felt like Republicans didn't have the votes. But if it's not this issue, it's the issue of primarying sitting Republicans that have that incumbent tag with them going into a contested primary, a contested runoff, a contested midterm election. It feels like Republicans are being whiplashed a little bit, and I have to imagine that's not being taken well.
No, I mean, Republicans are in a tough position with the midterms. You've got a president whose popularity is certainly waning, even with members of his own party. He's got pretty low approval numbers. There is a desire on Capitol Hill to do something that is broadly popular, or that would get Republicans something to run on before the midterms. That's that reconciliation, that third reconciliation package. That has proven very difficult, and I think there's a lot of skepticism that could get done by the time of the midterms. But there is that energy to do that, because Republicans do know that this is a tough cycle for them. It's a second-term president who is not very popular right now, who is pursuing a number of issues that aren't popular as well. I mean, this Iran war in particular is not very popular with voters. You talk to voters who are kind of perplexed as to why it's all happening when they're more concerned about, you know, the price that they're paying at the pump or the price that they're paying at the grocery store. So Republicans know that, this could be a really tough midterms for them. And I think there's a desire to maybe shake that up in a way. And that's where that reconciliation package comes in. That could be stuffed with things that Republicans view as broadly popular. I just think there's a, you know, Congress has not been known over the last few years as a fast moving body. And so it's unlikely that you could see something get done by the time of the midterms, just given the way that our politics and the Congress moves right now.
Dan, the issue of this fund, though, it seems to raise a broader question. Who gets to decide when someone has been wrongfully investigated or prosecuted? The courts, the Congress, the executive branch, or the taxpayers?
It's a totally fair question. And you had already seen some Democrats line up, and some folks say that they feel like they have been wronged by the federal government. There was going to be, I believe it was a 5-person panel that was going to be nominated for this fund to kind of decide and adjudicate these things. I don't think there was any insights into who would be on that 5-panel fund, because last week a judge basically hit pause on the entire thing, and so that stalled a lot of the work that was going on. But it's a totally fair question of, you know, who decides what the bar is of being wronged by the federal government, and where does that stop? I mean, there are people who probably have claims from decades ago who maybe they could go to this fund. Are people who feel like they've been wronged by the Trump administration, are they eligible for such a fund? I mean, the Trump administration made very clear that this was open to Democrats, independents, and Republicans. But it's a totally fair question of, like, who gets to decide the kind of wrongs that this fund was supposed to right? And I think that gets into why it was so broadly unpopular with Republicans as well. It's just not very, this is not really breaking news, but it's not very popular to voters broadly
right. When
you see a political party handing out money to people who they view as their supporters.
Dan Merica, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you got it. Coming up on the other side, American Axle goes to the strike. We'll talk about it with Merrick Masters. Next, it's JR Morning. Well, it's WJR's Tim McGraw VIP Experience. Your chance to rock when country music legend Tim McGraw brings his Poncho Guitar Tour to Pine Knot Music Theater August 28th. And you could win a pair of premium pavilion tickets, transportation courtesy of Metro Cars, and $100 to Buddy's Pizza. To enter, download that free WJR mobile app, find the secret keyword, and then text it to 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. More information is available to you at WJR.com. Good luck. Download that app, find that secret keyword, and then text it to us. And you could be going to the show. It's going to be a good one.
It will be.
Meanwhile, Dearborn Police, they're starting this new program. It's focused on aggressive driving. It's the aptly named Aggressive Driving Unit.
Yes.
And they're using some EVs, the Ford Mustang Mach-Es, and they will be on the prowl with their police officers. Dearborn Police Chief Issa Shaheen joins us this morning to talk about it. Chief, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning. How are you?
We're well. Let's talk a little bit about this. Why did you feel like now was a good time to focus on aggressive or careless drivers?
Well, so the reality is traffic safety is a top priority for the residents of our city in Dearborn. And while it's not just a problem in Dearborn, really all over, we've been tackling it for many years. But I wanted to change the look of the enforcement to really kind of catch folks driving in kind of their natural environment. People drive a little differently when they see a police car. So that's why we intentionally selected the Mach-E GT.
And Chief, what specifically qualifies as aggressive driving in the eyes of law enforcement? I mean, what behaviors are officers going to be targeting most aggressively?
So like excessive speeding, aggressive lane changes, tailgating, street racing, distracted driving, running stop signs and red lights. And like I said, you know, we've been using the cars now for a few weeks. I've driven it myself, and the driving habits of folks around these cars is wild.
Hmm. So what are they going to focus on, these officers assigned to this unit?
So we've had a traffic enforcement unit for many years, but like I said, just those kind of violations specifically, but they're going to be on our main thoroughfares and in our neighborhoods where our residents are complaining.
Yeah, because you say that this new aggressive driving unit was created because you heard concerns directly from residents. What were the people telling you?
Like, literally getting cut off by cars as they're driving down the roadway, cars just flying by them. Unfortunately, you know, Dearborn, not unfortunately, but the reality of Dearborn is Ford Road, Michigan Avenue, Southfield Freeway, these are main arteries that tens of thousands of motorists travel on a day to come in and out of Metro Detroit. So we see a lot of, as you might expect, kind of reckless driving behavior.
How many traffic citations do you issue a year on those that are driving like this?
That's a great question. Well, last year, I can tell you, we wrote more tickets than we ever had before. We had over 33,000 violations, and the majority of those are for the kinds of things that I talked about, speeding, reckless driving, running red lights and stop signs. We're really focused on driving behaviors other than, like, your low-level offenses here in the city.
And Chief, road rage incidents seem to make headlines more frequently now. Are you seeing an increase in aggressive confrontations between drivers?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I've been doing this for 28 years, and in the last few years, driving habits, especially coming out of COVID, people were far more aggressive with each other. And so these officers are really kind of focused on those driving behaviors, and we selected the Mach-E GT intentionally so that we could kind of witness some of that.
And you get a little more torque.
Yeah.
With those EVs, Chief.
Right.
Yeah. Are you expanding your police force on this, or are you just reassigning officers on this beat?
Well, traffic safety, its responsibility isn't just for these officers. All of our officers, myself on down to our newest recruits, are focused on traffic behaviors and writing citations. But these four officers that are in this unit are dedicated solely just to that mission every day.
And Chief, I remember speaking to Mayor Hamoud when he first came into office and asked him about, traffic and traffic policing. And he said you guys were going to do something different, that you guys were really going to be in the neighborhoods, really getting those quality of life issues and making sure that it's safe to play and live in the neighborhoods.
Well, look, I'm proud that Dearborn is the second safest large city in the state of Michigan, but we've got still work to do, and we're focused on improving quality of life issues every day for our residents.
Dearborn Police Chief Issa Shaheen, thanks so much for your time this morning, and we're looking forward to seeing those Mach-Es on the road.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Yeah,
all right,
got it.
See you, Chief.
You do the same. Hey, you remember this moment?
With dealing with everything we have to do with, look, if we finally beat Medicare.
Thank you, President Biden.
Remember that?
That's hard to forget.
Hard to forget. Hard to listen to still.
It's still, honestly, even to this day.
It's quite sad. But that was the moment Joe Biden, in that debate with Donald Trump, everything went sideways, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, after that debate, Jill Biden, they had a little post-debate rally. And here's what she said after that debate on her husband's performance.
Joe, you did such a great job. You answered every question. You knew all the facts. And let me ask the crowd, what did Trump do? Lie!
Well, now Jill Biden has a new book coming out. She has a new book coming out. And she is making the rounds on a number of different programs talking about her husband's presidency, their time in the White House. I think her book is called The View from the West Wing, a memoir.
Uh-huh.
So she's coming out and talking about what happened in that debate and in the aftermath of that debate, which inevitably led to then President Joe Biden dropping out of the race, Kamala Harris being elevated and eventually losing that presidential election to Donald Trump. But one of the things that Jill Biden said on CBS Sunday morning was this.
What happened? I don't know what happened. I mean, as I watched it, I thought, oh, my God, he's having a stroke. And it scared me to death.
Oh.
But then you did. But again, you went to the rally. Woo!
Yeah, you answered all
the questions, yes. Joe.
And then they went somewhere after that, right?
I think they went to a Waffle House after
exactly.
That. Now, if you were in that moment thinking your husband, if you're watching Marie and you think she's having a stroke, you going out to dinner?
Uh-uh. We're going to the doctor. We're going to the hospital right away. Something's going. We're going to get you checked out. If it says nothing, cool. But I need to make sure you're good.
I find it so unbelievably fascinating that Jill Biden is going out doing these, I guess, trying to PR everything that has happened.
Why?
Okay, first of all, I don't.
Why now?
Has anybody asked for a Jill Biden book? whatever.
No.
She's a former first lady. I get it. It's going to do well, all those things. But what you're doing now is you're reopening that wound.
Yes, you are.
And I'm reading these stories. The Democrats are like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe that we've got Joe Biden out here. They don't want to talk about Joe Biden's presidency.
No.
Because why? They were told by the administration. They hadn't seen the president. He was being kept behind closed doors for the most part.
Uh-huh, in the basement.
Well, just because his things were changing with him. And they were telling everybody else that he was fine.
He was good.
And everybody. They were going out and parroting that, yep. When in reality, maybe he wasn't so fine. So now Joe Biden is coming out on this redemption tour. I don't know what it is, but it is so unbelievable to me that we're doing this again.
I don't
relitigating
know.
This and trying to spin it. And again, if you believe in the moment, as she just said, that she thought her husband was having a stroke, and yet you go out and do the
and
other
have
things.
A rally and do all these other things.
I don't know about that. Remember, he was just a cold, and then he had some medicine to
cold
help.
Medicine and that.
I don't know about all that. 8 o'clock hour. It's next. All right, good to have you. 8 o'clock hour. Lots to talk about still this morning. And Governor Gretchen Whitmer was with Sam Altman, the head of OpenAI, in Saline at the Saline Barn as they broke ground on that new data center in Saline. And one of the things that Sam Altman had talked about was, you know, this could be the place where cancer gets cured. This is where things can happen thanks to what AI is becoming. And I think there is a lot of truth to that.
Absolutely. And this is like 250 acres. The facility is going to create thousands of union construction jobs, they say, generate about $8 million a year for local schools, and use a closed-loop cooling system designed to reduce water usage. So some things I'm sure that the community was concerned about, but there's still been some pushback from the community
well. Yeah, it's a $16 billion hyperscale project. It is one of the largest investments in Michigan history, an opportunity to create thousands of construction jobs, hundreds of permanent jobs as well.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the debate that's going on with data centers in this state. Is you look at a place like Ohio, where you know you have dozens and dozens and dozens of these centers open,
up and running
already.
Mm-hmm.
And other states,
Indiana,
in the region, Indiana, are not far behind. They are actively in the process of scaling up on their data centers.
Yeah.
And the fear is that you miss out if you're Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
If you drag your heels for too long, then you lose out on all of this economic development.
And you get the reputation that, you know, we did not
want
Michigan it
there. Michigan isn't a place to do business.
Yeah. So we won't even go that way.
And we, you know, look, time changes and things change. And, you know, it was chip manufacturers post-pandemic, right? Everybody wants a chip manufacturing plant. Well, Michigan was on the 2-yard line.
Yes.
And couldn't get it done. And that project was killed. But, you know, is this that next wave of important economic development for a state? And certainly Michigan is being viewed as one of the targets for it, but there is some questions around it. And I understand that from people who live in these communities where they're being built.
Sure.
But at the same time, you have to wonder, okay, well, what kind of economic benefit are they going to provide? It's going to be a big economic injection into the state. So if you get a couple of these, you know, you're all of a sudden at the center of this conversation as AI continues to develop.
And, you know, and when these data centers, if they come up in these, you know, smaller towns, you know, that's huge for work for those folks in those smaller towns,
sure.
You know, bringing, you know, a lot of economic benefit.
Yeah, gone are the days of, you know, the manufacturing plant in your town, right? I mean, we're way, 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 way past that.
Yeah, absolutely. Drivers in Detroit finally seeing some relief at the pump. Gas prices falling sharply over the past week. According to Gas Buddy, the average price for unleaded fuel in the city is now $4.33 per gallon, down about 25 cents just 7 days ago, and more than 50 cents lower than a month ago. But prices are still more than a dollar higher than this time last year. The lowest reported price in Detroit, around $3.79. Some stations, though, still as high as $5.99 a gallon. That sounds like California.
Right, what are we doing here? That's crazy.
Analysts say the drop is being driven by falling oil prices, shifting global supply concerns, including speculation over a possible U.S.-Iran agreement. However, Experts warn the relief may not last with renewed geopolitical tensions and market uncertainty potentially pushing prices back up in the weeks ahead.
Interesting. The Trump administration is said to be scrapping this nearly $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund. There's been a lot of pushback from Republicans in Congress, certainly Republicans in the Senate. They say that this has been a real roadblock for them to pass this reconciliation bill, which was funding for CBP and immigration enforcement. And this comes after a federal judge in Florida reopened the case against the IRS that Trump had filed.
Yeah.
And the judge had ordered the president and the DOJ to file brief to explain, quote, charges of collusion and whether the parties are truly adverse. In a separate case, another federal judge in Virginia also temporarily halted the fund from making any payouts. There were blue states that were saying that if these payouts do go through, we're going to tax you 100%, so you're not going to see a penny of it. But at the same time, it has become a real problem and a flashpoint for Republicans on Capitol Hill. And so it seems like, at least from different reports, that the president's backing away from it.
An $84 million housing development bringing 188 new homes to Detroit's Corktown neighborhood, part of a major effort to expand affordable housing in one of the city's fastest growing areas. The project being built on three sites off Trumbull and Bagley, where the former Clement Kern Gardens apartments once stood. Developers say 150 of the new units will be reserved for low-income residents, with rent starting as low as $600 a month. City leaders, including Mayor Mary Sheffield, calling the project a milestone for housing access in Detroit. Developers say the effort is largely funded through federal programs, grants, and housing vouchers. Officials say former residents will have the option to return without moving costs, with rent tied to income. While construction continues, some longtime Corktown residents say they welcome the change, calling it a sign of progress and even planning to move into the new units themselves. The development expected to be completed within the next several months. So by the end of this year, they'll have some new development over there. That's $600 a month rent?
And Michigan Central is a flashpoint there.
Right there.
Right? Yes. I mean, that has come back alive. It's absolutely stunningly beautiful.
It is. Corktown.
And Corktown
is
coming back a little bit.
Back,
yeah,
yes.
I love to see it. Meanwhile, Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu had a call yesterday. Things got a bit salty, if you will.
A little sailory over there?
Yeah. Donald Trump called Netanyahu crazy, according to reports, accused of ingratitude, according to a number of sources, Axios with the scoop. And he also put the brakes on Israel's plan to target Beirut in what Israel describes as their attacks on Hezbollah. But Netanyahu had released a statement saying that he had told Trump that Israel would continue to attack targets in Beirut if Hezbollah did not stop attacking Israel. And in the meantime, Israel would continue its operations in southern Lebanon. But the president, through intermediary, spoke with Hezbollah, and everything's been cooled down for the moment.
Okay.
For the moment.
Okay.
But he basically, one of the things that Donald Trump had said, according to U.S. officials in this Axios piece, you're bleeping crazy. You'd be in prison if it weren't for me. I'm saving your butt. He didn't say butt.
Yeah.
Everybody hates you now. Everybody hates Israel because of this. That's according to these reports coming out. Now, again, these are just reports.
Yeah, yeah.
Just reports. But then he went on to social media and released a True Social, posted there. And he said in part that he had a conversation with representatives of leaders of Hezbollah. They agreed to stop shooting at Israel. Likewise, Israel agreed to stop shooting at them. Let's see how long that lasts. Hopefully it will be for eternity. But Iran is tying the negotiations that they're having with the United States with this, between Israel and Lebanon and Hezbollah.
So if, you know, Israel and Hezbollah continue, it kind of, you know, throws a little monkey wrench into what the president's trying to do, getting a deal with Iran.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Tigers get a win yesterday. How
what
about
happened?
That? How
Yay!
About that? Back-to-back-to-back home runs for the Tigers, and they win it against the Tampa Bay Rays. So,
wow. Can we get a repeat?
That feels pretty good.
We won a game yesterday. And if we win one today, that's two in a row. We win one tomorrow, that's called a winning streak.
Major League, yes. Yeah, fantastic.
Yes.
Absolutely fantastic. It reminds me of like the old John Madden calls.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, huh, if you score more points than the other team, you're the winner. You know, and it's like, yeah, thanks, John.
Yeah, we didn't know that.
Appreciate it.
Yeah,
you see, you line up on the 5-yard line. You take the ball 5 yards to the end zone. That's called a touchdown.
You're like, oh, what a revolutionary mind this guy is. No, yeah. Coming up on the other side, you know, safe gun storage has been a huge focus here in the state of Michigan. Responsible gun owners do it really well.
A lot of young kids killed because guns are not stored.
Yeah, properly. And there was an event highlighting that. And we're going to be joined by Patrick Lynch, the president of Lynch Funeral Homes, coming up on the other side. They see this and they deal with it and they are helping families grieve this. We'll talk to him and get his perspective next in JR Morning. Well, ever since 2022, the number one cause of death amongst children in the United States between the ages of 1 and 19 are firearm-related injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Feels very preventable.
Yeah.
And only second to drug poisoning, cancer, suffocation, things like that. Uh-huh. Nasty stuff.
Yeah.
But the issues of gun violence continues. We see it all across our country. We see it here in the city of Detroit,
yeah.
Much less than we used to, but it hasn't gone away.
No.
And it obviously takes a toll on families that have to bury their son, their daughter, their niece, their nephew, their grandchild. It's absolutely horrific. But it also takes a toll on the community at large. It takes a toll on faith leaders.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a toll on local police. It takes a toll on state police. It takes a toll certainly on those that are trying to help usher in that transition for families like funeral directors. And Patty Lynch, the president of the Lynch Funeral Homes, joins us this morning. Patty, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning, guys.
You and a number of other faith leaders, funeral directors, and police officials got together on Sunday to hold a press conference. What is important for people to know from your perspective when you're trying to help people grieve that comes to your mind when it comes to gun violence, particularly in young children?
Well, you know, as you know, we deal with all kinds of situations and, you know, causes of death. And, you know, it's obviously something we don't want to deal with ever, the death of a child, especially the death of a child that is so preventable. And we don't have the normal platform or voices typically that the clergy have or politicians have, but you know, we deal with this more intensely and more intimately than pretty much any other group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And our family dealt very intimately with the Oxford shootings.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so we took the opportunity along with many other funeral directors from Metro Detroit to say, hey, listen, we're not here to debate one's right to, you know, protect themselves and to bear arms. What we're trying to do is get people to lock up their firearms because so many of these deaths are accidental and could have been avoided.
Patty, you know, we often hear about gun violence in major cities, but this effort emphasizes that it affects Detroit, college campuses like MSU, small towns like Oxford. Why is it important to break that geographic stereotype?
Right, yeah. I mean, this is something that's impacting everybody across socioeconomic lines and county lines. And, you know, it's just horrifying when some young person gets their hands on a gun and then accidentally shoots themselves or somebody else. And it's just like, this could have been avoided with a little bit more responsibility. Thank God it looks like the numbers are going down since they began enacting this safe storage law. It looks like the deaths for children by firearm is decreasing. So I think the public awareness is getting better, and that's all we can hope for is that it continues to get better. And so, you know, it was moving, and it was good to see so many funeral directors get together to voice their concern as well.
How do you and other funeral directors view your role in that moment? Obviously, you're looking after somebody's everything in a horrific moment, and you do what you can to help them along the way. But how do you view what your role is and or should be or needs to be in that moment?
Yeah, I mean, we can't do anything about death, and we can't do anything about, you know, terrible, untimely death. What we can do is try to help people get through it in a more, you know, organized and dignified way. People are in such a terrible fog and, you know, they're not necessarily thinking correctly. And so they need guidance, and it takes a whole community. And that's where, you know, friends and pastors and funeral directors and different community leaders come together to uphold people when they're going through this. Funeral directors have the, you know, unique and special privilege of being sort of the lead on it. And so we take it very seriously. But, and, you know, needless to say, we'd much rather be handling the funerals for 90-year-old grandparents and not for 10-year-old kids.
And for listeners, Patty, who you know, feel like this issue is politically stuck, maybe unlikely to change, what gives you, optimism that progress is still possible here in Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, it's not even about, the debate on whether or not we should be able to bear arms and people's right to protect themselves. That wasn't even at the forefront of the conversation. The conversation is really, hey, let's be more responsible with the rights and privileges we've been given as citizens of this great country. And I see that from friends and family on the left and the right, that nobody wants irresponsible gun ownership. Everybody wants responsible people to look after the guns that are in our midst. So that's, I think, the emphasis is let's avoid the deaths that are so preventable.
Patty Lynch with Lynch Funeral Homes, we appreciate your time. We appreciate everybody getting together and talking about this. It's an important issue, and hopefully we can save some kids from these
absolutely
senseless 100%. Acts of violence. Yeah, thanks. That's Patty Lynch. We appreciate your time. Meanwhile, did you hear Fifth Third Bank is making some decisions on closures? Fifth Third Bank to close 75 Michigan branches, including some former Comerica Bank locations as well. It's finalizing their list, but it's pretty extensive.
It is. I know one of the closures is the Comerica right down the street here on the Boulevard is one.
Yeah, they say after the closures, Fifth Third said it will operate 227 branches across Michigan, including 116 in the 5-county Metro Detroit area. It's building a stronger, more efficient branch network that supports customers today and positions the bank for long-term sustainable growth in Michigan and across our expanded footprint, according to a statement from Fifth Third. So they're going to continue serving many people, but it's just going to come in a different way after they acquired Comerica Bank.
Yeah, and I believe this month, the month of June, is when Comerica customers will be getting information about the change and the website and your accounts and all of that. I think they'll start getting notified about that this month, about how that's going to change, because by the fall, things will have changed over.
Things will have changed over, and just making sure people understand where they need to go, how they can do their banking is going to be really important. So, yeah, it's going to be good to get that information out there. Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, we'll get you caught up on some of the headlines. Stephen Moore is going to join us, the senior visiting fellow in economics at the Heritage Foundation. He's a former economic advisor to Donald Trump. The new Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, is looking at inflation in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say it's right, it's wrong, but it is a different perspective. And how is that going to impact our buying power? How are consumers going to take that? We'll talk to Stephen Moore on the other side. It's JR Morning. So out goes Jerome Powell, in comes Kevin Warsh, and there's an interesting piece out of the Wall Street Journal. Kevin Warsh wants the Fed to think differently about how it measures inflation instead of just relying on the PCE index. We don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But he wants to look at it differently, put more weight on trimmed inflation measures. It would remove extreme price spikes like sudden jumps in energy or food prices, and it would focus on underlying long-term trends instead of, you know, these short kind of one-time shocks into what they're looking at. Is that the way to approach this? And is it going to be beneficial when it comes to how they measure what the rates need to be? Stephen Moore, the former senior visiting fellow of economics at the Heritage Foundation, former economics advisor to Donald Trump, joins us. Stephen, it's good to have you back.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
What do you make of the way Kevin Warsh is addressing inflation, how he wants the Fed to think about it?
Well, first of all, the purpose of the Fed and the purpose of a monetary system and a currency is so that, you know, your currency can retain its value over time. And if you have wild swings in inflation like a peso, you know, nobody's going to use the currency. So we are blessed as Americans because the dollar is the world reserve currency. In other words, almost every major financial transaction throughout the globe is done in dollars because people trust the value of the dollar, that it's not going to take these wild swings. Although the good news is that one of the worst Fed chairmen in modern times, Jerome Powell, is finally gone from that job. He's the one who let, you know, inflation go up to 9%, swing up and down and up and down. Kevin Warsh is an outstanding choice. He is going to be an inflation hawk. He's going to bring that inflation number back down to below 2% and hopefully closer to zero. We're going to see hopefully the inflation rate for groceries and for gasoline and other things come down, which will benefit the American economy and American shoppers.
Stephen, historically, the Fed relies most heavily on the PCE index, which is still running closer to about 3.8%. If policymakers start
running close to what?
3.8%.
That's about right.
If policymakers, you know, start leaning more on lower adjusted measures, does that risk giving a false sense that inflation is under control?
That's a great question. I mean, the question you're asking sort of is, what measure do we use for a crisis? Do we use core inflation, which excludes energy and food? By the way, I have to say, as an economist, I've been doing this for 40 years, I never understood the whole idea of core inflation. I mean, to exclude food and energy, look, that's what we spend our money on. Why would you take that out of the equation? Here's what I think, what I think that Kevin Warsh will do and should do. And this is something that, you know, Art Laffer and Steve Forbes and I and others have all endorsed, which is to use what's called a price rule. In other words, look at what is happening right now. I'm talking to you on my cell phone. I could go to something called the CRB index, and it will show you in real time what is happening with the price of gold, what is happening to the price of wheat, what's happening to the price of copper, what's happening to the price of coal, all, you know, 35 major commodities. In real time, it'll show you whether those numbers are going up and down. That's what Kevin Warsh should be looking at, because it changes every minute, and it shows you what's happening to the direction of those commodities. And by the way, if commodity prices go up, if the price of wheat and gas goes up, what's going to happen to the price of things that you buy at the store? It's going to go up as well. So what I'm saying is, we've got to take the discretion away from the Fed and just follow a rule. Everybody knows what the rule is. And if the commodity prices are rising too quickly, it's time to, you know, lower the amount of money supply. And if prices are starting to fall, because deflation can be a bad thing too, you want to put more money into the economy. And that would be a system that would work quite well. And I think that's exactly what Kevin Warsh will do.
All right. Well, there are some out there that are saying, well, Warsh is just going to move the goalpost. He there's even this signal that he may move away from that 2% number and just focus on whether or not inflation is consistently stable and not necessarily worry that it's 2% or not. Is that an arbitrary number? Is he moving the goalpost to find whatever looks best?
Well, I think he wants inflation to get closer to zero. By the way, the reason
I agree.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, the reason that we have a 2% target is that there is one thing that's worse than inflation. You know what that is? Deflation. You know, in fact, in the Great Depression, you know, the worst decade, you know, perhaps ever for the U.S. economy, we actually had prices were falling, not rising. So farmers couldn't make any money. Blah, blah, blah. So the reason we have a 2% target is so we don't go below zero. But look, Kevin Warsh, here's the good news. Kevin Warsh is going to be one of the most outstanding Fed chairmen we've ever had. I think he'll be another Alan Greenspan. Remember, Greenspan was absolutely fantastic. We had the big boom in the 90s. And we're going to have a stable dollar, and we're going to retain the dollars. You've heard of BRICS. Have you guys heard
sure.
of that? That's
yeah.
the idea of, mm-hmm. you know, Brazil, Russia, yep. India, China are going to have a, you know, by the way, it's the stupidest idea. Why would anybody trust, you know, China, Russia, Brazil over the United States currency? It's never going to happen. But the point is that we want to make sure the dollar remains strong and stable. That will happen, and when that happens, it will benefit all Americans, and we'll see. Look, the news, by the way, in the economy over the last several weeks has been amazingly positive. You know, we're seeing record amounts of investment by businesses. The GDP numbers are 3-4%. You know, I know people are angry about food and gas prices, but, you know, you look at the – how about the stock market? My God, the NASDAQ, the S&P 500 – And the Dow Jones are at record highs today. We all own 401k plans, or most of us do, so we all benefit from a rising stock market. We're the only country in the world that's growing. Once we get that oil price back down to, you know, below $70 a barrel, I think you're going to see the biggest boom you ever saw.
And before we go, if inflation is still yeah. hovering closer to 3% than 2%, Stephen, what does that mean for interest rates in 2026? Are markets getting ahead of themselves and expecting cuts?
Well, when you said when what is it, 3%?
The
inflation rate?
Inflation rate is closer to 3
yeah.
than 2.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a very good point. You know, again, you get an A in economics today, my friend. So, you know, if the inflation is above 3%, then the Fed cannot be lowering the federal funds rate, because that would push more money to the economy. And what did Milton Friedman teach us? What is inflation? It's too many dollars chasing too few goods. So that's why I don't think right out of the gate you're going to see Kevin Warsh, even though Trump wants him to do it. I don't think now is the right time to be cutting interest rates, because we still have, as you said, inflation is running at 3.5-4%. I don't want to be flushing more money into an economy when you've got inflation at that level. If we get the inflation rate down to 2%, mm-hmm. then maybe we can start cutting those rates. But remember, by the way, one last thing I know on the way out. The government does not control the interest rate. That's this mythology out
right.
there. The interest rate is determined by the market, the demand and the supply of money, and that's what sets interest rates, not you know, some wizard behind a curtain in Washington.
Stephen Moore, we appreciate you as always. We'll talk again very soon. Thank you.
Okay, guys. Thanks. Have a great week.
Yeah,
you too.
You do the same. The Brad Galley Show is officially live. Brad Galley joins us next on JR Morning. Well, after a brief 15-year stint at Channel 7, Brad Galley has launched the Brad Galley Show. Exclusive interviews, original reporting, behind-the-scenes access, a lot of different sports storing telly, and it's going to be available to you on YouTube. And Brad Galley is in studio with us. It's nice to see you.
Thank you for having me this
Thanks
morning.
For coming
I guess
in.
It's not just YouTube, right? It's YouTube, Facebook, and it's everywhere.
Instagram, TikTok. TikTok was hot yesterday. We put a bunch of the clips up on TikTok, man. Uh-huh. A lot of people engaging on TikTok with some of this stuff. Excited to see Barry Sanders and Jameer Gibbs together. That was one of our first episodes we launched.
Oh, great.
For sure.
Yeah.
Get a couple of goats together. Walk us through this process. What was the last, you know, whatever, however long for you?
15 years at Channel 7. I always wanted to work there. I grew up in Troy, watching Don Shane. Got to intern with Don and Tom Lydon. Just amazing, amazing leaders. The leadership. Oh my gosh, and so talented. And the leadership at 7 has been awesome. And I told our GM Mike Murray, who I think the world of, still do. We left on great terms. The whole thing. I wanted to work there for 50 years, and there's still a part of me that will always drive past there and go, oh, and I'm watching my friends, and I'm rooting for them. But it just got to a point. I have kids that are 8 and 7. My wife and I have been together for 20 years. We've been married for almost 12, and the nighttime shift, the evening shift, working the 11 o'clock news, it was pulling on me. And at the same time, I thought, okay, with social media and everything that's going on, creatively, I feel like I can grow. And I feel like fans are dying for more content. And so I felt like I could satisfy the appetites of all of that. Be better at home more, be more creative and succeed more in my job, and give fans more content that they're desperate for in this day and age. Started exploring it. And after a few months, have landed here. And so we've launched with three episodes. Dusty May, Michigan's national championship winning coach, sat down with us inside Chrysler. We got Barry Sanders and Jahmyr Gibbs together. You didn't even really need me in the room because they just said nice things about each other, which is great. That's the goal, right? It's not about me, man. It's just trying to set people up and see their favorite players. And then Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker, again, just turn the mics on, let it roll. They sat down with us, you guys, and Lou goes, well, I'll sit on this side, second base side. Alan, you sit there. That's the shortstop side. Just two different seats right there. And we're just going to be feeding people that kind of content, daily content. And now I've talked for a while, so I'll kick it back to you guys. No, sorry.
Cool. I mean, for me, you know, you're going from this scheduled TV sportscast to a digital on-demand world where you can control the format, the length, and the storytelling and all that. What's the biggest creative freedom you gain? And what do you, you know, lose when you have to leave traditional TV behind?
I'll start. I'll lose. I mean, the built-in audience, right? How many people say that they have their station? People know what they do. They like you guys that's been their station forever, but you also sway them to turn to JR in the mornings, right? Like, oh, I really like Chris and Laura. I really like listening to Jamie. And by the way, Jamie, I love you. We're rooting for you always. We get her in your corner. She's amazing and a fighter, and I know she'll be back here with you guys soon.
Yes,
you
will.
I think that's the biggest thing, right? People like in our house, we grew up a seven family. And so to work there was incredible. So losing that audience, that built in platform, that's a traditional media asset that is so important to this community. Yeah. I stepped away from a really concrete, secure job that people would die for, that I would have died for a long time.
Yeah.
In building that relationship with people in this community for 15 years, I think name brands and trusting people when there's AI and how many times you open Facebook and there's a weird story you have no idea? Like it's a wild, wild west.
I wasn't even sure that you got Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker together.
Right?
I had to make sure. I had to double check that it wasn't AI. Yeah.
So I think what I gain is in this wild, wild west, I've become a reliable asset. That's my goal on a daily basis. And so now meeting people where they are on their phones, knowing, okay, I can go to Brad because I know he got Trammell and Whitaker together. I know when he tweets about a Lions story or when he posts a Dan Campbell quote, it's real. And I think with the confusion out there and people constantly still looking for what is reliable in that space, I feel like I know that space well in social media and trying to meet people there. And so that's where I've landed. I feel like I bridged the gap.
Well, and in this business too, right, there's, especially in sports, right, we love our sports here in this town.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's always the element of, you know, working with these teams but being fair to the fans, right, being fair to the people that are going through this, that are living vicariously through their teams, getting that enjoyment, feeling the heartbreak. So being a real journalist and asking tough questions in a fair way, that's how you develop that audience, and you've done it so incredibly. So you've built up the goodwill with the fans, but you've built up a relationship with the players that we also want to get close to.
Yeah, right? Thank you for saying that. And part of this was making sure I'd still be credentialed. I wouldn't have left had I not been credentialed. So those were conversations that I was having with the teams in doing that.
Sure.
They said yes, right? And I'll be at Lions OTAs this week. We'll be covering Red Wings training camp and covering the team, and I can't wait to get back to cover the Tigers this week. Be with the Pistons, Michigan State, when the women's pro teams get here. We'll be doing that. But I plan to be with those teams, and it's because of the relationships that I have, yes, with the fans that watch the content, but also with the players. And another huge player in all of this, when people wonder, okay, great, everybody and their brother can start a YouTube channel. I've got great support behind me. I have partners behind me. So Moran Buick GMC of Sterling Heights has jumped on to be our presenting sponsor. Todd Flood of Flood Law has jumped on. I know you know Todd.
He's part of the family.
Right. And he jumped on immediately, said he believes it, and he said what everyone's thinking. This is where people are, man. And you do sports content that people love and the following is there. So he jumped on. Both of those guys have jumped on with their amazing brands to be a part of this as well.
And, you know, you've also been deeply involved in community work, and I want to let people know about that, including, you know, long-time volunteer efforts. How does that side of your life kind of influence the kind of stories that you want to tell moving forward?
I think being local and being from here, I think there's value in that, right? When you turn the TV on and you turn the radio on, you open the newspaper, and you can tell somebody's from here.
Yeah.
People can smell a phony in this town, and they can also love somebody who's authentic. And if you're not going to be authentic, they'll probably chew you up and spit you out in this town. And Angel's Place, my wife and I have been involved in for a long time. Our football manager at Brother Rice, his name's Mike, he's been a friend forever. But the Angel's Place, man, they house people with developmental and physical disabilities. And over the last few years, their big dinner, they go after sports figures as a speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And they've asked me to MC it, and then they started asking me to get speakers. Well, in the midst of all this, we got Kirk Gibson 1 year to do it as he's going through his own fight with Parkinson's. And just to be around those kind of stories, when you see people like that, like Kirk Gibson, that are icons in this town, helping people that are in need, holy smokes. Talk about authenticity. That's what this town loves. That's what people in this town love. Kirk Gibson stood on this stage at this dinner and surprised everybody and said, I'm putting down money of my own. If you're not going to match me, he looks through people's souls.
Right.
I'm Gibby, and you know what I'm going to say to you if you don't donate. That stage was filled with people that made pledges. That'll be a big part of what we're about to do.
It's really cool.
That's great,
the
man.
Brad Galley Show is officially live. Brad Galley, it's good to see you.
And congratulations
now,
again.
Thank you.
And now we're going to be talking to you about these interviews that you're doing, so keep that phone close by.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
That's Brad Galley. It's going to do it for us. Kevin Eats and All Talk coming up next. See ya.